This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hi, I'm Sharad Kutan, and welcome to the show that walks you through some fundamental concepts in the social sciences and humanities. Together with Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, we try to reveal how various thinkers have grappled with theories and frameworks, the better to understand how society works. Each week, we discuss a classic text or an idea we hope will shed light on the world around you. This week, we have Mohan Ambikapaka. He is the assistant professor at Tulane University in the U.S. in the state of
Louisiana,
right? And he's with the Department of Communications. But when I knew Mohan many years ago in Kuala Lumpur, you were going off to do your PhD, and it was in anthropology, I believe.
Yes, I do have a PhD in anthropology. It's closely affiliated with communication because the field of cultural studies, which has kind of blended into anthropology in the last, 20 years, has a lot of overlaps. So, anthropologists are appealing for communication departments as well these days because we kind of bring in not only two kinds of literature training, but we also come with a double methodology. We can do the textual analysis and we can do the ethnographic fieldwork analysis. So we're trained in both. So, these days everybody wants more for the price of one. So,
well, great. So don't despair if you want to do some things arcane sounding like anthropology, which is what I study as well. There is a job waiting for you after you graduate.
But this is a particular branch of anthropology you're talking about. You're talking about cultural anthropology most specifically.
Correct.
Right? Not archaeology, which also tend to fall in
those guys are a bit more limited.
Yeah.
But don't let that turn you off. Okay, you can see the conversation's already started. Mohan, when we first talked about you coming on the show, we were thinking about a discussion of race, not only because you're located in the U.S. and because we've had the Ferguson issue, we've had, again, the specter of race politics in America writ large. Why isn't there racial justice? What does it matter that there's a president who apparently is black in the White House? Why hasn't it done nothing to change the dynamics of race in America? Fuad, of course, you also spent a lot of time in the U.S.
8 years.
In fact, both of you, yeah. For me, the U.S. is a specter that I view through, media like Hollywood and television. So how do we begin a discussion about race that would be adequate to what's happening there?
This is a topic that is close to me because I teach a course called Critical Race Theory. It's a body of work that tries to address this kind of issue. It's a study of race within the liberal democratic Western political context. And oftentimes, I think situated in Malaysia, and coming from Malaysia, we used to have a Malaysian liberal fantasy. Malaysian liberals have this fantasy that, if we develop our country enough to, in the image of the West, then we would solve our race problems. Now, having gone to the West and having experienced it and also become a scholar of Western political dynamics and race, I can tell you that that's not going to solve the problem because there's lots of evidence that shows how a liberal democratic and Western political system is in fact very much racialized and they're grappling with their own historical conundrums. And I think the first step to think about this contradiction is to understand that there's an ideal theory of liberal democracy and then there's liberal democracy as it actually unfolds in practice. And the theory of liberal democracy oftentimes doesn't reflect that gap between how its precepts are encoded in the law and how it actually unfolds on the ground. So many critical race theorists, starting with perhaps the work of Charles Mills, who wrote a book called The Racial Contract, argues that the classic model of liberal democracy, which is based on Rousseau's notion of a social contract, and that the liberal democracy is a polity that is based on the rule of law and abstract deliverance of justice. So the color of your skin and your identity shouldn't play a role in the kind of justice that is meted out. Mills disputes this because he calls it the ideal theory of justice. And this body of work is largely represented by a theoretician like John Rawls, whose theory of justice stands as a certain kind of, manual or classic text of liberal justice. But Mills takes issue because he says that that's an ideal theory. That's not the way Western polities have historically behaved or continue to behave. And he comes with this alternative notion called the racial contract. And the racial contract is basically a domination contract. They are both institutional and everyday processes in the West and in the U.S. that socially construct people through race and then also embed them within relations of subordination and domination. And these are ongoing processes. They're not just for one time or they happen in the past because of slavery or Jim Crow, but they happen, they continue to be reiterative processes that reproduce themselves institutionally and within the law. And that's the key thing.
That's a lot there, especially on your first point about how Malaysians kind of view alternatives to racism. And as you rightly put, the Western model has become the standard to aspire to. But perhaps before we go further to unpack some of the things you said, maybe you can start with what liberal democracy means, because there are many different types. There's social democracy, there's democratic socialism, for example. But it seems to me that the order here is such that people are trying to grapple with liberal democracy. So what does that mean and what are its starting points and foundations?
Can I also add that, you know, you did your PhD fieldwork actually in Britain, in the UK, and your work was on race there too, right? So whether that context also makes a difference to the kind of discussion we might have about race. Is there, you know, a distinction between, say, the historical trajectory that Britain's had in terms of its race issues and the US?
Yes, I'm a comparativist, so you know I study race from that kind of multiple angles, the UK, the US, and Malaysia are the three sites that I've concentrated on primarily, also do a little bit on the Caribbean. But I think what's fundamental to the ideology of a liberal democracy is this notion that it's governed not by caprice, it's governed not by, you know, the tyranny of the majority, it's not governed by pure political will alone, but it's governed by rule of law. There's something that is above what Chakrabarti would call like political society, which oftentimes people say is what the third world is, but that's a very, you know, stark and inaccurate contrast. Like, you know, the third world is governed more by this primordial contestations and conflicts, and the West is governed, yes, they have conflicts, class conflicts, race conflicts, but there's rule of law that mediates, and the state is a rational actor that steps in and solves whatever problems may come up. So the illiberal actor is out there in society, and the state is institutionally liberal. Liberal not in the sense that there is a kind of abstract standing above the feuds of society approach that the state takes. So when it's able to stand above and neutrally, objectively, universally mediate among all the differences that are in society, then you get what we call a liberal democratic society. So abstract proceduralism is very key to the functioning of law.
That's very interesting. So how do you connect Mill's insights with sort of the Malaysian context where it isn't colorblind? There is rule of law is pretty partial. And from there, it looks like the Liberal Democratic Project seems something to prize.
We are somewhat, just like the US, we are somewhat of a ideal liberal democratic state. I mean, you know, there are elements of that, you know, both within the US and within Malaysia. Now, you know, if we were 100% political society, and it was just about warlords fighting each other, then I don't think that, I mean, that's not recognizable as Malaysia. Even the parties that flaunt the law and compromise the law, they still, you know, go to the Palace of Justice to get the rubber stamp and have a certain semblance that we have rule of law. So it seems that at that basic level, people still need the imprimatur of the sanction of law to do whatever they want to do, even though we may question the corruption and the biases that are within it. But we still refer to law as, and all political parties are still wanting the sanction of law for their actions. And that is similar to the US. Now, the process works very differently. Maybe the corruption is not as overt or as blatant, but you know, when you think about the institutionalized lobbying process that gives incredible advantages to corporations, you know, over the political system and capital, basically. Capital has a huge weight on how laws are made in the US. And typically, you know, racial groups have incredible power over the state in the US and are continuously vying to keep that power. And the majority group in the US are white. So, you know, whites have had a hold on racial power in the US, you know, continuously. There's been, historians now agree that there are probably two or three seminal moments where that has been broken. The first Reconstruction period, which was after the Civil War in the US. For about 12 years, they experimented with a genuine racial democracy, but it failed and it was broken down, and we got the Jim Crow order, the segregation order that replaced slavery. Now that goes all the way until civil rights, and oftentimes people call civil rights a second reconstruction attempt in the US to make it a genuine racial democracy. And I think with Ferguson, many people are saying that we have come to the end of that second period of reconstruction and it's failed again. And so now we are looking for the next thing.
Okay, I just want to address the issue of kind of ideal types, right? It seems a little too easy to knock liberal democracy as an ideal because in actuality fails. But isn't that part of the project of political philosophy to kind of imagine how a system might work in a kind of aspirational sense so that this is our horizon that we work towards? And even in sociology, to work through the ideal types, you know, the idea that those are heuristic devices,
yeah.
Right? So, so those, is it adequate to attack it on that basis? You know, because without it, what would we do?
That's a great question. I think the critique is exactly on point. And what is being questioned is not simply its everyday failings, but the very structure of liberal democracy itself. It's not to say that the critique is that the West is hypocritical, for example. We hear that often, you know, whenever the West criticizes the East or the Third World, it's like, oh, it's very hypocritical, look at Ferguson. That's not the critique that the thinkers and scholars are necessarily saying. What they're saying is that the very internal structures of liberal democracy are themselves very contradictory. Let me give a clear example. So one of the big people behind critical race theory as it emerges in the 70s and 80s, you know, is a lawyer by the name of Derrick Bell, first African-American lawyer, tenured at Harvard Law School, has written many, many books, Faces at the Bottom of the Well, The Silent Covenant, among many others. But he was a practicing civil rights lawyer, an associate of Thurgood Marshall and all the key stalwarts of the civil rights era. And he tried over 500 cases of school desegregation and lost most of them. Even after the law was changed, after Brown versus Board of Education, which made separate and equal and illegal policy, they had a very difficult time trying to desegregate America practically, like, you know, from the point of the schools even, which is where people send their children, they live, things of that nature. So why was it so difficult? And after trying and litigating all these cases, you know, Bell concludes, well, yes, okay, you can say that whites are racist, they have prejudices, and therefore they don't want to desegregate. Well, if you just think of racism as prejudice, it only goes so far to explain what is taking place, because why are the courts then not ruling in favor of desegregation? So you have this institutional problem then. And if liberal democracy is supposed to stand above prejudices, right, then you expect the state to come and tell racist white people, no, what you're doing is not democratic, not liberal, you need to integrate your schools. But in fact, you saw the opposite happening again and again and again on the level of the courts from learned judges, so on and so forth. So Bell identifies this as the interest convergence dilemma. And what he says is that in the American judicial system, whenever the rights of minorities come up against the pre-given or assumed rights of whites, that creates this interest convergence dilemma. And the liberal judicial system is, in a very nuanced way, biased towards protecting what it's already habitually accustomed to in terms of the democratic rights that it enjoys as a white citizenry. So, for example, the right of a white person to have freedom of association. If I want to associate with black people, fine. If I don't want to associate with black people, that's my right. Okay, freedom, that's a democratic principle, right? Mm-hmm. So you can't, nothing wrong with that. I mean, you can't force anybody to integrate and, you know, have multicultural friends or anything like that, or live in a multicultural neighborhood. But then the rights of minorities say, like, well, you've been putting us in the worst areas, the worst schools. We want to now improve our situations, and we want to be able to come to the better schools and integrate. So that creates an interest convergence dilemma. And the courts are only able to give a kind of justice that does not dilute or take away from the rights of whites. So, go ahead.
We're going to have to come back. That's fascinating. And by giving an example, you're really going to help us to think through this. But we're going to take a short break and be back for part two of Night School. You've been listening to Mohan Ambikapaka. He is assistant professor at Tulane University in the Department of Communication. And of course, Ahmad Fuad Rahmat and myself, Sharad Kutin. Night School, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, I'm Shoaib Kutan, and Night School continues with Ahmad Fuad Rahmat and our guest Mohan Ambikapaka. He is assistant professor at Tulane University in Louisiana.
In New Orleans.
Okay, in the Department of Communication. That part of the world is really mysterious to me because I think the view of America is often on its coast. So it's either California or it's New York, you know. And Louisiana, maybe some spooky movies from, you know, some time ago. But
all the Malaysians are talking about NCIS New Orleans now, new TV show that they are starting to watch.
They have a New Orleans version now, huh?
Yes.
All right. How exciting. Okay. So back to your interest convergence dilemma, because it really does help us understand, you know, you say white people are racist, for instance, if that was the assertion. You could also say, well, white judges are also racist, and therefore you have the dilemma. But you're actually saying something much more interesting, which is that institutionally, you have a culture in which it figures the problem differently. And therefore, even if you had a black judge, maybe you would still have the dilemma, right?
Yes.
But it seems to me that also the point is that it's not so much that the system doesn't work, it's that the assumptions that the system starts with will ensure that it doesn't work. And in this case, what challenges that assumption?
It doesn't work for some groups, right? I mean, this is a group that is excluded, that's trying to change the very terms which that society had operated.
Yes, but that system claims to speak for everybody. So in that sense, the system fails.
So that's the liberal contradiction.
Yeah, yes.
And so that's why Mill says it is not a colorblind racial contract. There is already a racialized basis to the operation of democratic rights and the recognition of democratic rights. So if you're trying to reconstruct society, but you can't compromise a racist person's right to want to live in a segregated community, keep their schools all white, then how are minorities going to be able to access those rights that they are after, you know, the equality rights that they are after? And what we've seen in the judicial system is that the U.S. judicial system has consistently upheld, you know, the rights of whites to retain their democratic civil liberties, even if they are racially coded.
Could you extend this argument to, say, the question of the exclusion of other minority groups, including, say, sexual minorities? And we see the whole advance of gay rights in America. Does that come up against the same sort of wall?
It does, in part. Now, the gay rights movement at the present juncture, insofar as it is become mainstream, has focused very narrowly on this question of gay marriage.
And civil union.
And a lot of the LGBTQ movements, you know, on the ground have criticized the sort of mainstreaming of the gay movement, you know, because it sort of models this very bourgeois, middle class, you know, notion of what gay issues are. You know, that you've got everything else in place, all you need now is the right to marry, and then you'll be like everybody else.
But isn't that the dream, though, of that kind of democratic society? Everybody has the same rights, that you can't, I mean, if there is this idea that you can't force other people to, or you can't force people to associate with people they don't want to associate with, you also, isn't there a strong impulse in America that everybody should be equal, that there's a kind of radical impulse to equality, that, you know, at least notionally.
Yeah, and equality is part of the problem in some ways. The triumvirate in the French Revolution, which, you know, in many ways laid the foundations for, you know, liberal legal systems, you know, liberty, equality, fraternity. Now, all those three things don't necessarily sit well with each other. Equality and fraternity, for example. Fraternity is supposed to create fraternity among, you know, all the citizenry. Well, equality means, if you define it as being able to exercise one's individual rights, then, you know, to hell with fraternity, because you can't force me as an individual to do something else, right? So it's not very easy to put equality, when it's defined as individual rights, to fraternity, which is a social ideal.
To what extent is the problem stemmed from its assumptions of agency, right? Because liberalism is tied to a distinct view of individuals, a distinct view of communities that are often atomized.
That is the ideology of it. And so what critical race theory, though, unpacks is that it assumes a liberal individual actor that is in fact profoundly racialized and already classed. A middle-class individual actor has agency because the problems of economic resources is already solved. They just need to have the freedom to associate, the freedom to speak. Those register of freedoms, the schedule of freedoms, assumes that you're not poor, assumes that you can reproduce your sustenance and your survival. You know, it doesn't imagine that holder of those rights has problems like, you know, can I get food tomorrow. The liberal system then has, as much as it has a problem with racial minorities, also has a problem with poor people, mm-hmm. you know, because it says, oh, you have your right. You have the right to find jobs if you want, you know, but what if you can't get jobs? You know, what if you historically have come from poor communities? Well, the liberal system doesn't have anything to say about that. You know, it just assumes that you are. So that's the critique with the gay issue as well. It just assumes that the gay subject is already a middle-class subject who has solved all the other questions. Or the gayness does not discriminate on those kinds of levels. So you already come ready-made as a bourgeois person.
Now, what about the question of the state, at least in this kind of philosophical imaginary, right? Yes, the courts are there as an arm of government. But how much power does the subject in a liberal democracy want to give to the state to re-engineer the country, re-engineer society in particular, especially on things like gender issues and racial issues? I mean, do they want? Is that part of the problem?
I think that's the front lines of the battle right now in the U.S. is between those who see the state as possibly a vehicle for re-engineering society towards more progressive and egalitarian ends, and those who want to keep the state out of people's business. There's a lot of talk about small government. The Republicans run a lot on this issue. There's a lot of talk of state rights, so devolving power from the center, the federal center, towards giving the individual states more autonomy over all kinds of issues. So in recent times, for example, you've seen the striking down of the Voting Act, with certain provisions of the Voting Act that was one of the key pillars of the civil rights achievement, which was to force districts that have historically discriminated against African Americans or suppressed their vote, you know, to subject themselves to federal oversight. And the courts recently have started to strike down, you know, the provisions of the Voting Rights Act and giving back that power to run your own elections to the local bodies, which historically have tended to act against minority interests. So it is done in the name of a democratic principle, which is we need to have local democracy, we need to have popular participation, so the state should not continue to meddle in that exercise of democracy. So that's one way of interpreting what you're doing as a democratic thing. You know, we want our power back to the local community. It sounds good on the face of it, but what if that local community is a segregated, whites-only or white-majority community and wants to keep it that way and wants to keep its interests protected through the very exercise of local democracy, right? Because if it doesn't have a federal state overseeing it and saying, hey, you got to behave nicely to your minority population and you got to let them participate in elections and, you know, have a chance at winning elections and not be gerrymandered out of the possibility of winning elections and things of that nature, if that oversight is not there, which they are calling as an undemocratic hindrance to their local participation, then what do the minorities do? Minorities appeal to the federal state to say, like, we've been historically discriminated by these local people, and we need you to step in to regulate their discriminatory behavior. But both parties are arguing on the basis of being on appealing to democratic norms. Nobody's arguing outside of democratic norms. So then, which are these democratic arguments prevailed? You go with the ones that obviously will result in benefits to whites, you know, or do you go with the interpretation of democratic reform that helps to bolster up the participation of minorities? Now, if there had been 500 years of history without any historical discrimination, one could say you just start on a level playing field. But there's never been a level playing field, right? So there's still an urgent need for trying to redress the legacies of racism from the past and the current racism. But that's the kind of argument that takes place.
This is specifically an American problem. Now, you said you're a comparativist and that, you know, you worked in the UK and you also look at Malaysia. In terms of these issues, how does it work out in these different contexts?
So when I was working in the UK, I did field work in East London, which is a very multiracial area. It's the most diverse area in the UK. Most diverse municipality, the municipality of Newham in East London. And we had a lot of problems around police abuse and racial violence, racial attacks against minorities. The UK has a history of antagonism towards immigrants that comes from a long history, but the modern period you know, follows World War II, when many migrants came from the former colonies and started to settle in the UK, establishing large-scale colonies. There have been minorities in the UK since the time of the Roman garrisons. You know, there were black people in the UK since the time of the Roman garrisons, but large-scale, distinctive ethnic communities started to establish themselves after World War II. And this settlement provoked a number of right-wing responses. I mean, the settlement was initially encouraged by the British state, but then there was a right-wing response mobilizing itself and creating a kind of fascist politics.
Enoch Powell and people like
that. Enoch Powell and, you know, Mosley and many others. But Powell is probably the more prominent one. And so one of the things that started to happen is in the 70s, you saw the emergence of the National Front, which is kind of a thuggish far-right group whose job was to go beat up immigrants in the neighborhood on the streets. They took street-level action, so to speak. And that kind of racial attack issue and racial violence issue continues. A very famous case called the Stephen Lawrence case in the UK. A young teenager was knifed in a bus stop. And, you know, it took 10, 12 years of campaigning before a royal inquiry was established. And the conduct of the police, which had investigated the Stephen Lawrence case very poorly, you know, were found to be, in the words of the commission, institutionally racist. And that altered the tone of the discourse in the UK and put this word into legal parlance that the collective failure of any state organization to provide service based on the color of skin, ethnicity, religion was now known as institutional racism, and it was something the British state recognized as a problem. You know, so we confronted both the racial attacks that were going on in East London that would come up from time to time in an organization, excellent anti-racist organization called the Newer Monitoring Project, and as well as the institutional failures that people who had been victims of racial violence had to encounter secondarily when they tried to go to the liberal state for their justice. So you get attacked on the streets, and then you go to the police, and then, you know, it's laughed off. Or if you can't speak English properly, you know, they take advantage of that and they tell you to go away, or they tell you, like, oh, did you provoke him, or who started the fight? And there are all kinds of ways in which the claims that minorities were making about their suffering to the liberal state was being dismissed. And you needed activist organizations like the New Monitoring Project to basically come on the side of minority victims and advocate and monitor the state and say, no, we know what you're trying to do. And, you know, we know about institutional racism. And, you know, so we are watching how you're treating our client. You know, so the system didn't work on its own automatically. It required this additional layer of community and grassroots pressure to even get it to work right. So once again, the question emerged, why doesn't the liberal system just do its job?
Interesting stuff, Mohan. When you mentioned French Revolution earlier, it got me to think about how it was that the liberal system came to prevail. Because after the fall of the monarchy, there was a lot of conflict between the left and the right, what's come to be identified today as the left and right factions, where, you know, the left, the Jacobins, were more radical, and the Girondins were the property class. And during that struggle, eventually the Girondins came to ascension, and they were the ones who designed the liberal project. And at the heart of it was the protection of property and the property class, essentially. And I wonder if that is still the case today, that ultimately, for all the exclusions that the liberal project produces, what's at the essence of it, and no, it's not fashionable to talk about essences nowadays, is the protection of the moneyed class. Because I think about it too, and it's not necessarily the case that it's absolutely racist, especially in the American sense, because you have the East Asian migrant communities and the South Asian, a huge, significant population of South Asian communities who have sort of thrived in the system to become business owners, to become professionals, and to align themselves with the bourgeoisie. So is it fundamentally a class problem? Because if I worry too that we might be sliding into another problem of abstraction when we say that it's everybody who's not white, right? So that's another kind of idealizing as well. So what are your thoughts on that?
I think you've hit the nail on the head in part. I would agree with you. In the work that I did with in the UK, for example, so one of the things that I found out when I was doing my research is I had an occasion to engage with the then one of the senior commissioners of the Metropolitan Police and the ranking black police officer, Tariq Ghaffour, who is a Bangladeshi person of Bangladeshi origin and the highest ranking black police officer in the UK. And I took him to task in this forum about the poor rate of investigation and convictions and clearance on cases involving racial harassment and attacks. And I asked him, why is it that the London police keeps having, you know, this institutional issue? And now they have accepted they have institutional problems, not just one bad police officer. They have an institutional problem. So I asked, and I've been doing this research, I've been involved with this organization, I see this, why is racial harassment not being taken seriously? And he provided a very illuminating answer that I write about in an article that's coming out called Liberal Exceptions in Ethnic and Racial Studies. But he says, he said very frankly and almost abruptly, he said, well, it's not the top operational priorities that we are given. And I said, what are your operational priorities that you're given? He said, the public gives us priorities like policing crimes against property, burglary, car theft, those kinds of things. Anything to do with property occupies the most important register for operational priority within the police. Now, when you look at that situation ostensibly, you say there's nothing racial to it, because everybody can own property, everybody will be protected by this. But that's not true. The majority of UK people do not own significant property. They do not own houses, things of that nature. The majority of populations are not property classes. But yet, the police force of a nation finds that that particular crime is the most important crime that they should devote the resources to. Whereas if you're an immigrant who's being attacked on the streets by a gang of hoodlums or far-right activists, they recognize it as a crime on the books. But in operational priority, they don't send out an immediate response, or they don't behave as if that is the most important. Racism is not the most important crime. It's crimes against property that are the most important crimes. And he was very frank to say that this is what we are judged by, but how we deal with crimes against property. And so why blame us? He made the point to me.
You know, we're running out of time, and, you know, we've not come to Malaysia, which is not and does not model itself, well, okay, this is a contentious point, as a liberal democracy, right? And what exactly is Malaysia's model? What does it aspire to? We have some semblance of a liberal democracy in terms of our institutions, at least nominally. How they operate and what they operate for is an entirely different question. It seems like we really should have you back, Mohan, on another show to work out the third of your the three countries that you kind of focus
Malaysia.
On.
Malaysia.
Yeah, Malaysia, because we haven't done that today. But I just want to quickly ask you, before we wrap up, for a recommendation for anybody interested in looking at this issue, especially things like that interest convergence dilemma and such, on a kind of more conceptual level, because it seems like Malaysians, we all know about race. In some ways, you know, that's not the problem. The problem is, how do we think more clearly about it? So what would you recommend?
I would recommend Derek Bell, of course, whose idea it was, Interest Convergence Dilemma. There are more recent writers. There's a great book that I teach called Colorblind Racism, you know, by Eduardo Bonilla Silva. There's Joao Costa Vargas, who was my advisor at the same time. He's got a book called Catching Hell in the City of Angels, which is about racism in Los Angeles. There's Kimberly Crenshaw that looks at the intersections of gender and race in the legal system in the US. There's Mari Matsuda, to quickly mention the question about Asians, you know, which has been also thought and studied about. That a reigning idea is this notion of the model minority, and Asians are somehow this model minority in the American system. That really bears a lot of unpacking, which we may not have the time to do here. But Mari Matsuda is a critical legal theorist that has worked on this issue. In fact, she's one of the founding figures of critical race theory as well. And her work would be very important to look at. Charles Mills, as I mentioned, there's a great book by Ashraf Rushdie that came out, Yale University Press, called American Lynching, which not only talks about the lynchings of the past, but the implications of that history of lynching. How did something like extra legal racial violence freely operate for such a long time within a liberal democratic system? It's an interesting question, isn't it? You can string up somebody and put a noose around them and kill them, you know, without a due process, which is one of the precepts of a liberal democracy. And this was ongoing.
And with complete impunity
and sometimes the support of the police. And so when you look at this, this was an exercise of a certain kind of white racial power that went beyond legality.
Fuad, recommendations?
Well, Mohan mentioned Charles Mills, whom I had the pleasure of hanging out with before. It was in Cartagena, Colombia. Yeah, very exotic. but he wrote, he has an early work that I turn to a lot. It's called From Class to Race during his Marxist days. It's really good. It's theoretical, but illuminates some of the racial blind spots in Marxist theory. It's very useful.
I don't know much about the US, but I have read much of, you know, black literature is something I'm interested in. But I would recommend Cornel West's little book called Race Matters. It's very simple, very straightforward little piece. And he's, of course, a philosopher, isn't he?
I have one other a really good one to recommend is a Chinese-American philosopher and activist. Nobody knows very much, for example, about the Asian participation in the black civil rights movement. But there were many Asians who actually did participate.
Mm-hmm. Grace Lee Boggs. Steve Aoki.
Richard Aoki.
Yeah.
Yuri Kochiyama. Mm-hmm. You know, and Grace Lee Boggs, you know, among all of them, is the one who's written the most. And, you know, a lot of her works and articles are available online. And her last work is American Revolutionary, which offers a very interesting way forward mm-hmm. in terms of the anti-racist struggle in the U.S.
And she's still alive. She's at 96, I think.
She's 99 and she's in hospice care.
Yeah, yeah.
But she's still alive and so far still
she's seen a lot of history, yeah. Yeah.
Wonderful. Okay, Mohan, are you on social media? Are you on Facebook or
Absolutely.
Twitter? Absolutely. You're on Facebook.
That's the way I keep in touch with Malaysia.
Okay, so you can get in touch with Mohan. I guess he might add you. I don't know if he does that. But we have our own Facebook page, BFM Night School. And you can have maybe a conversation there with listeners. Also, are you on Twitter?
I'm not.
Okay, well, neither is Fuad. I am at Sharad Kutin. And well, so we look forward to carrying on this conversation on social media. Thank you so much, Mohan. You've been listening to Mohan Ambikapaka. He is an assistant professor at Tulane University in the U.S. somewhere in the deep south.
That's right. Yeah. The deep south.
The deep south. Okay. And of course, I'm Fuad Rahmat. And myself, Sharad Kutin, on Night School, BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.